Good afternoon. Welcome to the EcoNews Report. I'm your host this week, Jennifer Kalt, Director of Humboldt Baykeeper. The EcoNews Report is brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, EcoNews. Today, my guest is Mike Wilson, who has been the Humboldt Bay Harbor Commissioner for the 3rd District. Is that right, Mike?
Yep, the 3rd District.
3rd District, which represents the Arcata, Manila, Blue Lake area. He's been the commissioner for the past 8 years, and he is about to leave that duty to become supervisor representing the same district on the Board of Supervisors for Humboldt County. So Mike is here today to talk about the Humboldt Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District and its efforts to protect Humboldt Bay while promoting sustainable economic development over the past 8 years. So Mike, thanks so much for being on the EcoNews Report today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So let's start off talking about just some background about the Humboldt Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District, because it's not just a harbor. It's got all these other facets.
Right. It's a very unique district. It was created in 1970 through the California legislature and then ratified by the voters of Humboldt County. And it is unique in that it's a harbor, recreation, and conservation district all bundled into one, which is unusual. I don't think there's any like it anywhere on the West Coast, or I don't know if anywhere in the United States, really. And so it takes on those three purviews, which, you know, it was really the first time that people thought about these things as integrated. And I think that's a really great step forward that was made in sort of that enlightened time in 1970. And so the district does represent the entire county in that there's 5 seats that represent the same constituency as the districts that are for county supervisors. We call them divisions, actually, for the Harbor District, but for the county, they're called districts. I've been representing 3rd Division for the last 10 years, so I've been through 3 elections.
You're 2 years into your 3rd term, but
that's
you're
correct.
Departing early because you got elected to be on the Board of Supervisors.
That is correct. Yep.
I stand corrected.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't know that the Harbor District actually does represent everyone in the county. There are various operations the Harbor District has outside of Humboldt Bay, just real quickly. Mm-hmm. There's operations in Shelter Cove.
For instance, in Shelter Cove, yeah. And to be quite honest, the district, the way it's created, really has a very broad potential purview. Because it has a harbor district, it actually can be for shipping and navigation, but also roads, railroads, airports, and many other places around the country, port districts. It's varied in that way. And then as a conservation district, it doesn't really have boundaries necessarily. We have jurisdictional boundaries from an environmental review perspective around Humboldt Bay, but that doesn't mean that the jurisdiction or the projects that the district could take on could be external to that. And the same with recreation. And that's why the entire county was included is part of that. But then, so then you're right, we do have works that we do down in Shelter Cove area as well. And now we're actually looking at actually providing the spaces for fish buying and selling in terms of like supporting the commercial fleet down there as well. And those services are for fee. So we actually currently make money on that in terms of like the district, at least enough to keep those services going.
Okay, so back to the core area, though, that you serve, which is Humboldt Bay, has really 3 parts to it, and mm-hmm. they're managed really quite differently. So give mm-hmm. a sense for how that's
right.
divided up.
So there's kind of the North Bay, which is Arcata Bay, and then there's sort of the middle section of the bay, which tends to be around Eureka and the Samoa area, and that's the middle section, and then the southern area, which is down near Table Bluff. And in the North Bay, which is Arcata Bay, is managed fairly mixed use. So it has great natural resources in terms of its ability to be a nursery and an estuarine system for fish species and bird species and crustaceans and everything else, as well as aquaculture, hunting, fishing, recreational boating, sightseeing, bird watching. All those activities really occur in the North Bay. And it's managed for that very mixed use way.
And by aquaculture, you mean oyster farms, right?
Well, shellfish. Oyster is not the only shellfish grown in Humboldt Bay. There's also Manila clams are also grown in the bay as well, and I think there might be even some mussels too. And then the middle section of the bay is kind of what we consider the more industrially oriented part of the bay, sort of more what we now deem as kind of working waterfront. It's the new term that we use for these waterfronts because it really takes into account how it's more of an ecosystem, both a natural and economic ecosystem that are interrelated, and it's a working waterfront. So you really have to have healthy ecosystems to have these waterfronts where you have, again, recreation, industrial activities, commercial activities, and cultural activities. And then in the southern end of the bay is mostly managed for natural resources exclusively. There's the wildlife refuge, which takes up a huge part of that bay. There's an MPA down in the southern end of the bay.
A marine protected area.
Thank you. There's hunting and fishing that occurs down in there, but there's no aquaculture. There's no industrial businesses so much. I mean, except for right in the Fields Landing where there's our shipyard is down there, which is where the commercial vessels and recreational vessels are pulled out and worked on at Fields Landing, yeah.
Humboldt Bay has a vast amount of eelgrass relative to most of California where a lot of the eelgrass has been really destroyed. And so we're really fortunate to have these sort of three separate areas of the bay in a sense because mm-hmm. it is such an important habitat type. It's a type of wetland, but its importance in buffering the effects of ocean acidification are just now starting to come to light. You know, the fact that a lot of oyster activities have been moved to Humboldt Bay recently from Puget Sound and other areas where low pH is causing a lot of problems for the oyster industry, it's really important to recognize the interconnectedness of the eelgrass and the water quality and the oyster production.
Right. Well, eelgrass is vastly important as a habitat, certainly, for many vital species that we see around Humboldt Bay. Some are hunted, like the brant, and it's also vital habitat for fisheries, other crustaceans, anything. Basically, it provides a lot of surface area for a lot of microorganisms to grow and attach to and then be fed off of. And so it provides a ton of nutrients in Humboldt Bay. And certainly it provides buffering because it's a plant that's doing what plants do in the atmosphere, but it does it in the water. There's all of that. In that reference with regards to the oyster industry, it's again, the shellfish industry from the other areas are coming here, not because they're necessarily doing more growing out of oysters, although that's something, you know, that we're looking at and certainly some of the other entities are looking at, but really it's the seed production. It's actually done on land next to or adjacent to. It's again part of that working waterfront model where you're providing jobs where they're basically taking oysters, clams, and mussels and creating the seed that then they export that seed or spat, it's called, to Washington, Oregon, and actually internationally. And the reason is because Humboldt Bay is designated is disease-free. Really, diseases that attack the shell of the shellfish at that microscopic level don't exist in Humboldt Bay where they do exist in other places. And so the oyster and shellfish growers are very protective of water quality in Humboldt Bay, and they're really protective of the off chance that there could be an infection here. That would be a very bad thing, and they're vigilant in that regard. And so stormwater is really important to that industry in terms of protecting the bay in that way, even in industrial sense. So when the pulp mills first came into Humboldt Bay in 1964, it was an oyster farmer that sued to make sure that those industries didn't put their outfall pipes into the bay, which was what they were going to do. That same 30 million gallons a day of toxic materials would have been going into Humboldt Bay had it not been for an industry that relied on clean water. And so that tradition still exists today when it comes to clean water. And so although there are impacts that occur with this industry on Humboldt Bay, and we have to always do more to reduce and mitigate those impacts. But there's also benefits that we also derive from that, even not just economically, but even from an environmental perspective. And we have to balance all of those things as we move forward. And you were saying, you know, the impacts to eelgrass in other places from industry, but, you know, a lot of the impacts to eelgrass just comes from urban and suburban development too. And so if you look at Morro Bay, highly impacted, they're having a hard time keeping barely a blade of eelgrass, you know, basically making water quality a very tough issue. And they have shellfish farms in there too. In San Francisco Bay, one of the solutions they're looking at to actually try and mitigate for water quality problems that they have is actually reestablishing shellfish reefs, because shellfish do have that ability to their filter feeders. But in some places, you need that cleaning to occur.
Well, and the oyster reefs that are being created in San Francisco Bay, I would imagine there are native oysters. Is that right? Olympia oysters?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. Even right now, there is an experiment going in Humboldt Bay. There's an experimental oyster reef constructed last week as part of a mitigation project with PG&E as part of their redevelopment of the power plant down there. What's unique about this wasn't needed for mitigation necessarily. There was a certain freedom in the ability to create a kind of diversity diverse habitat and then monitor how that gets colonized and to see how we can use that information in the future to potentially create more native reefs in Humboldt Bay.
A few weeks ago, I had Waylon Gilkerson on the EcoNews report to talk about the eelgrass management plan for the Humboldt Bay area, which is a Harbor District project. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So the Harbor District received a grant, I believe, from the US EPA to launch this regional eelgrass management plan so that there could be, rather than a project-by-project way of dealing with eelgrass mitigations, to have a regional approach.
The crux of the problem really is that eelgrass grows so well in Humboldt Bay. The issue happens to be because it's a protected resource, any impact you do to it really has very strict mitigations to it. So if you want to do any of these working waterfront activities, then you have to mitigate for the loss of eelgrass, which happens to have at least some areas where you have these zones. And so the problem has been typically maybe with a normal wetland impacts, you'd say, oh, I'll just build a wetland over here, over there. But, you know, in the Humboldt Bay area, everything's either wet when you're talking about wetlands. But in the bay, if it can grow eelgrass, it grows eelgrass. And so finding a place to mitigate for loss is difficult and very expensive when you're doing it on a project by project basis. And so what we're trying to do is to figure out a way that maybe there are management policies that enhance or encourage eelgrass on a broader sense that you do that then can be used as mitigation for these sort of spot impacts that can occur as opposed to just doing these as one-off projects.
Right. And the Harbor District is the lead agency as far as permitting goes. And so dealing with those kinds of projects on a regular basis. But the Harbor District also has its own projects that it needs to address impacts and mitigation for eelgrass, right?
Right. Especially right now for us, it has a lot to do with dredging. As part of an agreement in working with PG&E is that they would help our community by help us purchase a dredge for the community in exchange that we would dredge that channel for them on their basically as they relinquish responsibility for that. And we're doing that. But the kind of the biggest holdup for us is mitigating for the eelgrass within that previously dredged channel is now filled in some. Now there's eelgrass in there. The agencies are requiring mitigation for that eelgrass in there. And so part of this is to figure out how we're going to mitigate for that. We have a lot of, you know, dredging projects coming up in Humboldt Bay. And when I'm talking channels, I'm talking what we call off channels, like our marinas and these smaller little areas. The issues are either eelgrass or where does the dredge spoils get deposited or both. And those are big permitting issues for us and they can cost a lot. And certainly we're looking at the future of dealing with now we're trying to get back to dredging the marinas, both Woodley Island and Eureka, and trying to figure out a place to put the spoils from that is extremely complicated from a regulatory perspective and will likely turn out to be pretty expensive. And when we put that expense onto the slip fees, which is what we charge for folks to put their boats in these marinas, it's going to be an issue for sure. And we'll probably, as a community, hear more about that as we move forward.
So it's so expensive, you can't possibly recoup the fees from the slip fees.
Well, it depends on the methods that you use to do that and the disposal methods that you can do. The problem with that is if you say you can't get it from the slip fees, where do you get it from? It either comes from that or it comes from the taxpayer, one or the other. And so that's just one of those things you deal with in local government is how do you pay for these services? Is it through fees or is it through taxes? Right now, it's a combination of both.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the EcoNews Report. I'm your host, Jennifer Cult with Humboldt Baykeeper, and I'm speaking with Mike Wilson about the Humboldt Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District. The Army Corps of Engineers dredges the main shipping channel, so we're not talking about those.
And Army Corps is by law prohibited from dredging anything but their own channels. So when you see those big dredges that are in the bay that come in once a year, they aren't doing, you know, near the docks or in the marinas. That's, we are responsible that is for that as a local community. The equipment is much smaller. The volumes are much smaller. I mean, they're orders of magnitude smaller.
I really want to talk about the pulp mill, even though much has been said about the pulp mill in recent years, but we can't really have a show about the last 10 years of the Humboldt Bay Harbor District without talking about what I would say is the Harbor District's really crowning achievement, if you will, to protect Humboldt Bay.
Our scariest one, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So just briefly give an overview of what happened there.
Well, we had two pulp mills built in 1964 on Humboldt Bay, really to deal with wood waste and to create a byproduct of that from wood waste to then be able to ship out this pulp. Those went on until the 90s. One of those pulp mills went out of business, and then another one went out of business, and that was the Louisiana Pacific Pulp Mill. Another company tried to take it over. They had it for a while, and then a Chinese company, Evergreen Pulp, took it over for a few years. And right at the basically at the collapse of the financial system in about 2008, their finances dried up and they literally left town overnight. They left what was a huge pulp mill that was fully operational and operating, and they just cold stopped. They just shut it down. They didn't burn off of any of the materials that you typically do when you shut down a pulp mill, but they just left in the middle of the night. This was a tragedy for the workers. It was a tragedy for the community in many different ways. And so a group of folks tried to take it over, tried to put in a paper mill. It didn't happen. Things were deteriorating quickly on the site. The district was reviewing it to look at it because quite often harbor districts all up and down the West Coast, typically what happens, the way most harbor districts actually have gotten land to create harbor infrastructures and economic development infrastructures is because places basically go bankrupt and they acquire them. So we are looking at it, but what we soon realize is what we really had on our hands wasn't as much of an opportunity as it was a very big threat to our community. There was 3 million gallons of toxic materials on this site of pH-14 caustic liquids in tanks that were leaking, that were having problems structurally. There was large amounts of sulfuric acid also next to those things. I mean, we're talking about a potential catastrophe that could have killed people, and that if these tanks released and were combining with these sulfuric acids, then you could have seen explosive results and caustic clouds, and you could have seen spills into the bay, and it would have really been damaging economically, environmentally, human health-wise. I mean, this was a potential disaster. So the district decided that the best way to attack this problem was really to just own it and take it on. And some people really had criticisms of that perspective, but what we knew is that just pointing the finger wasn't going to be enough for this to really happen. We needed to actually take control of the situation.
Yeah, and lots of agencies tried pointing the finger for a long time, and right. That wasn't doing anything.
It wasn't. And we saw that that was the case. And certainly it wasn't just that, because you really, if you do look at the infrastructure at that site, there was 200,000 square feet of beautiful warehouse space. There was an industrial hookups in terms of electric and in terms of gas. And then, of course, water. There was a water pipeline all coming to one place. There was an outfall pipe, which is an important piece of infrastructure if you're dealing with trying to figure out what to do about wastewater in our community, not just for this site, but in general. So there was a lot of infrastructure that you just don't find in one place. So there was this huge problem and this huge opportunity kind of combined into one. So after we acquired the property, I was at a project that I'd worked on previously, which is at Indian Island, the cleanup of the Tulawat ceremonial site there. And EPA was in town as part of one of their projects. And the director for the tribe, we were meeting with that person from the EPA, and the director said, "Hey, how about that spot over there?" And I said, "Yeah, can I take you to take a look at the pulp mill site?" And we took a tour of it that day. I think it was like a Thursday. And I think by Monday, or maybe it was even the next day, within days, it was declared an emergency site. The Coast Guard emergency response team came in. The EPA basically took the site over, and cleanup started on that property. And as part of that, the EPA asked the district what we could do to help with that financially. So we secured a loan from one of our tenants on the bay, which is Coast Seafoods, to help move the materials out of these tanks. And we found a place that would take them. It was a pulp mill in Longview, Washington, that would take the materials. And so we did that. Coast's interest in that was basically they were freaking out because, again, their industry was at risk. Because if these tanks had ruptured, if this had gone into the bay, it would have impacted this shellfish industry that relies on clean water, not just in the immediate, but in also in the long term in terms of reputation. So it was important to them to make sure to see what they could do to help in this situation. Once those materials were removed, the EPA then, they also got rid of the sulfuric acids. There was also a large industrial lab on the site, which also had a huge amount of toxic chemicals in it. I mean, what we also found out what had happened is a lot of those chemicals were unstable in that they were in refrigerated units. And when they left left in the middle of the night. They actually just turned off the refrigerators and walked away. You know, there was a real danger that there could have been a huge fire. It was just a dangerous situation. And we've basically taken care of about 95% of that issue. And now we're really more into the debris cleanup. There's some subsurface contamination that Louisiana Pacific is responsible for the cleanup. And we're working with them to get that done.
And now there are some new uses of that space, right? Well, can you talk a little bit about what kinds of businesses have gone into the former pulp mill?
Sure. I can give you an example of four businesses that are in there now. So Taylor Mariculture has come in and they're doing one of their seed facilities in there. And they're also using the dock out front to grow out the spat for export. Coast Seafoods is also leasing a large space in there to do the same thing. And we expect probably one other shellfish group to come in. We've also got a pilot project that Humboldt State University is doing. They have one of the foremost osmotic power experts in the world is at Humboldt State. And if you want to know what osmotic power is, if you're familiar with reverse osmosis as a way to clean water, where you create a lot of pressure with your dirty water and you push it through a membrane, right, that leaves behind the impurities and pushes out through clean water. Osmotic power is basically the reverse of that, where you take what's not really dirty water, but highly saline water and clean water and put them next to each other through this membrane. And that membrane creates a chemical reaction, or basically creates pressure. It's a way to create power in the opposite way that you use power for reverse osmosis. Some people might call it reverse osmosis, but the more elegant way is just to call it osmotic power. So there's some millions of dollars that the university is putting forward to do this pilot project, because we have a site that has a lot of fresh water and a lot of salt water, and maybe there's a potential and future power source in that. But really what they're looking at is power recovery for reverse osmosis plants is really kind of the ultimate thing that they're looking at. But they're going to be creating a lot of saline water as part of what they're doing. So we have now a salt producer that's co-located with them. So there's now an artisanal salt producer making Humboldt Bay salt. I've had it. It's addicting. I love it. I can't tell you how great it is to cook with. It's wonderful stuff, especially on fish and just about anything else. So I'm a big proponent of Humboldt Bay salt now.
What's the company name?
Humboldt Flake, yeah, maybe.
I think it's funny, yeah.
That's a good name, huh, isn't it? Yeah, well, anyways, it's great stuff. I think Taylor Chocolates has a product line that uses that salt as well.
Oh, wow, cool.
Yummy. Of course, there's a lot of potential for more businesses in that area as well as around Humboldt Bay. And we've talked about that a lot, where we have what's called coastal dependent zoning around Humboldt Bay. We have 1,200 acres of these lands around Humboldt Bay. And by comparison, say, that's zoned for coastal dependent industrial. It means industrial activities that can only be associated with the coast. And if you imagine, the Port of Oakland is 900 acres. So we know that Humboldt Bay will never become the Port of Oakland. And yet we are so burdened with the zoning, yet we have all this infrastructure. And so we're really looking at the ability to relook at this and at least on a temporary or interim basis, get businesses into some of these zones where these infrastructure exists. And what I mean by infrastructure, I really mean these buildings and these utilities, so that we can actually use these buildings and utilities so they just don't fall away and create more blight around Humboldt Bay. But it's also an opportunity to bring people in from the shadows. And like we are trying to do with sort of the cannabis industry, in terms of like bringing people in by making it legal, and then also bringing people into the permitting process so that we can then address these environmental issues. We have a lot of businesses around Humboldt Bay that are non-compliant, I guess would be the term, in their uses of these lands around Humboldt Bay. If we can get them into this interim permitting process, then we can make sure that their businesses are permitted in other ways, both for stormwater, looking for opportunities for restoration on those parcels, you know, and really start to evaluate and then really jump into what we need to do, which is the next phase of the local coastal plan process. There's these local coastal plans that were set up by the Coastal Act, also around 1970, in that same sort of enlightened era. And every community has them. We have one. but we need an upgrade to that to address these land use issues so that we can be smarter, more environmentally conscious, and really economically efficient on how we use these properties.
An important reason to be redeveloping a lot of these old industrial properties, too, is to be addressing the legacy of contamination that was left behind. And, you know, one of Humboldt Baykeeper's concerns is when these businesses go in without getting all the proper permitting and whatnot. And a lot of the people who are doing them don't understand that there are these contamination issues that need to be dealt with. Well, first you have to understand that it is a contaminated site you're dealing with. So it is an appropriate reuse of some of these sites to have more modern industrial or commercial activities there. But we have to do it knowing full well what we're doing and protecting the bay and the environment. I wondered if you have some just parting thoughts about your tenure on the Harbor District and where the Harbor District has come in the last 10 years.
Well, I think it's really come a long ways in the last 10 years. It's interesting. I received, I guess, a sort of criticism the other day. Someone said, you know, the Harbor District or Humboldt Bay District isn't environmental enough. And I would say true. I mean, but from my perspective, there's almost never an entity that's environmental enough. We're always on that arc of moving forward. But from the perspective of looking at it from where we were 10 years ago to today, I'd say we really are on that arc. We really changed the conversation from thinking that Humboldt Bay was going to be really reliant on this large industrial vision, that we're going to have this industrial port and that was what was going to drive, you know, any sort of potential for environmental upgrades or recreational sorts of things, to this new paradigm, looking at working waterfronts, looking at the integration and reliance that we have on our environment, on clean water, and how it integrates with those activities that we do, even if it relates to shipping in the way that we do now, because right now, mostly what we ship out is biomass, and that's an important part of that sort of forest management ecosystem. But then there's also the issue of this eelgrass and how it's important in buffering water quality for our aquaculture industries, and then our aquaculture industries also supporting those ecosystems in terms of how it impacts our fisheries, how it impacts our tourism, how it impacts our commercial industries along the waterfront, and how they all work together. So I'm just really happy with where we're at now, but it's always progress. It's always moving forward. It's not quite enough, and that's the way we're always going to have to think about it. And even on Monday of this week, our staff was working diligently to pull out what would be a sinking ship, the 1091, which is a former, basically a ship that was used in the Normandy invasion, was stationed in the South Sea during the nuclear experiments, was then commissioned to be a tuna boat, but then had been a museum in Eureka on the waterfront, and it was sinking, and we didn't want another ship to sink. And so over the last weekend, we've pumped out 10,000 gallons of water to be oil water separated and took it across the bay. And on Monday, it was pulled out and pulled on shore so that we can assess whether its seaworthiness, because we knew it was sinking and we knew how to do something with it. And working with the city of Eureka, we made that happen. And that's just something we do every day at that Harbor District, is if it's not protecting the bay from sinking ships, it's protecting it from water quality issues related to stormwater. It's promoting estuarine restoration projects. It's looking at eelgrass management. I mean, it's the whole Marianne, and then trying to make the bay a culturally dynamic and, you know, recreationally accessible place. And so it's been great fun. It's been the best public service I can imagine, really.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being here today, Mike, and we will certainly wish you the best, and we'll be there seeing what's going to happen with the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors, which you take office on in January. Is that right?
That's right. January 3rd at 8:30 in the morning, I think.
Okay. So people can find out more about the Harbor District by going to their website, which I have to say is a wealth of information. There's a ton of documents about sea level rise there and so many different interesting projects and policy documents and so on. It's humboldtbay.org is the website. We'll have Mike back again before too long. This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Jennifer Kalt of Humboldt Baykeeper, and I've been your host for the past half hour. I was speaking with Mike Wilson of the Humboldt Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District about the district's projects and transitions over the years. If you have questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org. Previous shows are also posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. The EcoNews Report is produced at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again next week for the EcoNews Report.